us around. But we hope you've had a chance beforehand to kind of get to know some folks and socialize. And if you'd like to, unfortunately they closed this restaurant down shortly after 9 when we wrap up, but feel free to form little cliques and kind of go talk about the lecture, you know, at nearby watering holes or sort of whatever suits. We do want to kind of promote the social aspect of this, which we know is an important part of it. For those of you new to the drill, we are a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization. We do charge a $5 admission to defray the expenses of our equipment and our publicity, our website, and things like that. But we have no paid staff, and a rather remarkable organization in that way. We've been running for 25 years or so with more or less continuous program with no paid staff and really no organized fundraising other than the contributions we take at the door. And if you'd like to become a regular, you can get a 6-month membership for 12 lectures for $35, which is quite a savings over the long run. So if you think you want to be a regular partaker, be sure to look at that option. And if you didn't get a chance to pound the way in because you didn't know the deal or anything, then look for Rob here on the way out, and we'll take your contribution on the way out. And the food is between you and El Phoenix. We have no part in that, but be sure that you find your check on your way out, because it is a little bit confusing with a full room like this and people arriving at different times. And please remember your wait staff. They're working very hard tonight on a busy night, and so please be generous with them. They work very hard to provide service to you, and you should keep them in mind. Our format is we have about a 45 to 60 minute lecture followed by 20 or 30 minutes of questions and answers. So we ask that you hold your questions to the end. We have a big group. We will try to give hopefully most of you that have a question a chance to have one succinct question posed at the speaker and to have it answered. I say speaker, we actually have a duo tonight, which is a little bit of a departure for us and be an interesting variation. And I will say that no one can accuse us of a narrow topic tonight. That's one criticism I don't think we have to worry about too much. As presenters tonight, we have Mr. John Wiley, who is a retired member of the Texas Instrument senior technical staff, and has a bachelor's in physics from Illinois Wesleyan and a master's in physics from Northwestern University, so that's kind of our physicist slot. And then to complement that, we have Jerry Mittens, who is a psychologist and a Presbyterian minister with degrees in social sciences, theology, and psychology, and has the title of professor emeritus at Austin College. And their title is Brief Histories and Current Developments in Natural Sciences, Cosmology, Quantum Physics, plus Dark Matter and Energy, Woven in Dialogue with Concepts of Philosophy, Psychology, Neuroscience, Theology, and Consciousness. So we hope you're not doing anything for the next couple of weeks, because this will take a little bit of time. But I now present Jerry and Jerry and John for you, please.
Well, he gave the long version of the title. We actually have a little brief. It's been an interesting topic, though, to get into, because I've been in this about 50 years. And to read the current type of information that is coming out in philosophy, neurosciences, etc. Now, let me make, we have to do this when we get to some of the lectures at different universities. I have to say, John and I have no financial interest in what is we provide today. And so, be assured of that. When we get to the time, the format we will follow, we have planned, we might rotate 4 times different subtopics. Then I'm going to have you involved in a special role, so get ready. But there have been topics like this that I've read recently. Why is there something rather than nothing? Okay, there's work out on this. What is all this stuff? And then Jim Holt wrote, why does the world exist? Now, philosophers and neuroscientists and cosmologists are really addressing this in exciting ways. If you don't know this, I have difficulty hearing. So when it comes to question and answer, please speak slowly. How many of you have difficulty hearing?
I didn't know you.
Yes. Well, do you know what the love call is of the hard of hearing?
The love call.
What? 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 So, I hope you can see this over there. There's going to be a few simple slides, just diagrams that are not complicated at all. Oh, yes. Would you hold this a minute? To facilitate timing, and sometimes I've been known to get carried away. When it gets to be about 6-7 minutes, give me a gentle jerk, not a big peek. All right. Let me start with several models of relating science and faith. To make it a contrast, the science is the square, John likes the box, and faith is a circle. And the interaction of the two is what we're going to try to get across. There's many ways to look at this, so you may develop your own. Whoops. I got it. Where's my one or
one? One more the other way.
Whoa! This is a cool thing. All right. This will permit me also to speak of a relationship that has been historical. Historically, centuries back, that's gravity. Religion has tried to be above science. And that went on, and terrible things have happened in the last 200 years. We'll get to that slide in a moment. And this is unfortunate, because there's still this tension that goes on. Then in recent years, there are some very outspoken persons, like Dawkins and Harris, who do not engage in too much dialogue, but they discredit religion. And it's difficult to engage them with discussion. Now, here is a model that I'd just like to share with you, which is a type of complementary model, in which there is an overlap in various sizes, depending on the topic. And this is where the dialogue can be very interesting. There are some areas that different methodologies. It helps to appreciate it, but that overlap occurs. Now, my piece of art comes out here. Remember, science is a square and circle is religion. But this is just a little clip of the DNA, RNA type of helix, spiral helix. So just imagine this going off the board. I didn't know how to draw it exactly. But this is occurring in a very fruitful type of way. And I think we'll see much more dialogue as this unfurls. Now, as you know, existentialists and philosophers and theologians have been very interested in the topic of meaning and purpose. And I want to focus on this for just a brief time. The basic elements that are involved here in science, we have the most basic of elements, and John will give a little history how this comes about, that these elements of the most basic type become more and more complex. Complexity is a very important item here. This is why the subtitle, Mysteries and Uncertainties. Over billions of years, organisms have developed. And then they've evolved even further. The human being is kind of a brief period of peak, we consider ourselves. And there's a debate going on with people from Harvard about whether human beings can be cooperative or competitive. If you want to know some sources on this, it's very interesting debate. Homo erectus developed, the Neanderthals, Homo sapiens. Now, like animals, we have DNA and RNA that share considerably, and even hunters and gatherers developed early forms of religious, art, education, technology, and science. Now, the question can be, what is the purpose of creation? I teach sometimes global ethics. Sustainability is one of those that complements what we know. We have parallel universes now that are being hypothesized. Okay? Now I'm going to get into the sources of meaning. Often human beings confront this type of question. I've been a pastor. Parishioners will get into this. I've had several thousand clients in therapy, several thousand students who get very interested in this. And I'm going to give you what I have evolved over 50 years as a personal hypothesis. And you might consider it and test it for yourself. I submit that I find meaning when I am important to someone who is important to me. Let me just run that by now. My most important source of meaning comes from my relationship with Carol. My family, my friends, colleagues, and the ultimate source for me is I'm important to God when I let him be important to me. So I submit that for your consideration. When people have meaning, how are we doing?
We'll get about 9 minutes in.
So. Oh, okay. Creativity, that's my field of research, is fostered. Stress is managed better. Love, faith, tradition. So let me just repeat that. We find meaning about things like what a person does, what a person loves, and the relationships that we have to whatever God we have. Now,
what if we don't have them?
That's a dilemma that you may face. We'll discuss that later. Now I'm going to give a transition here. Physicists and magicians also have visions. And so John is going to address the area of multiverses, including magic. So bring on John. It's been a joy to work with you.
All right, thank you, Jerry. I think I will forego your leash, but
give
me a hand signal, maybe.
Okay. Six, seven. Okay.
I want to comment that I think this group has probably reached a new level tonight. You've never had a speaker that is less qualified to speak about philosophy than I am. The last philosophy exposure I had was like 50 years ago in my undergraduate school. We took a humanities survey course, and I remember a little about philosophy, but not a lot. What I'm going to try to do tonight is talk about some science items, a few stories that hopefully will give you some familiarity with why these things we're talking about are interesting and actually fun to work on for people who are involved. I do have a couple of friends that I have lunch with occasionally who did major in philosophy. And we have discussions back and forth. So I got a little tired of them lording it over me philosophically. So I went to the internet, which of course is should be our source of all uncertainties. And I looked up, I Googled philosopher jokes. And that is not an oxymoron. And I found one that I think perfectly merges this conflict between philosophy and science together. It's called Newton's First Law of Philosophers. Has anyone heard that one? For every philosopher, there is an equal and opposite philosopher. Jerry mentioned, as he was closing up, talking about magic and a multiverse. I'd like to do a little audience participation on the magic part of it. I'd like you to put yourself in the frame of mind that you are your grandparents, one of them, when they were young adults, like 20 years old, perhaps. Now, in my case, that's about the turn of the 20th century, and probably similar for others, and maybe a little later for others. But the question is, what do we have today? What capabilities, technologies, and things do we have today that they, if they had they known about them, would have considered as magic? And we can just kind of volunteer topics.
Cell phones.
Cell phone.
Radio.
Radio.
Ice.
Ice? I think they had ice.
They didn't have ice makers.
Ice makers?
Yeah, they didn't have
it. Okay. Think about your daily life and your work or your interactions with human.
Internet.
Airplanes.
Internet, airplanes. Autos.
iPhone. High-quality software.
Say again? High quality software? Do we have it today? What about medical things?
Transplants.
MRI machines. So forth. Okay. A whole lot of things. I think we could go on for a long time. But there is a saying that probably came out of science fiction, but it's been used by serious scientists last time period, that any advanced civilization is indistinguishable from magic. So just think what our grandchildren, when they're our age, what will they have that we would consider as magic? Don't know. It's speculation. Although there's a lot of things and a lot of areas going on that offer so-called magical solutions, I think. Let's talk a minute briefly about the multiverse. Notice I make it singular. One of the current theories about our universe is that it's one of many. It's one of a group of universes contained within an overall multiverse. This idea has been growing. Nobody's demonstrated it yet. And I've had some interesting discussion with Professor Radford about this. But if you look at the theory of the Big Bang in our universe, immediately, instantaneously after the Big Bang was an expansion, which is given the name inflation. And that's what helped make the universe grow and gave it some of the properties it has today. That the mathematics of all that lends itself to other inflations occurring from some fluctuation of energies. You maybe heard about string theory. That's a theory in physics. String theory theorizes that what we call particles and atomic entities are actually vibrating strings of energy which appear to us to be particles or subatomic particles. And the big item with string theory is that it requires multiple dimensions, more than the four that we have access to and can visualize and sense. So multiple dimensions in imaginary space or imaginary spaces is an idea that's gaining momentum. And I predict when our grandchildren of our age, the idea of a multiverse will be well accepted and not unusual. I think it's time for me to hand the podium back to Jerry.
John and I have known each other 40 years. In the last 18 months, we've plan a dozen to 15 different series that are like this. You have one of them before you. So there is a great interest on the part of a wide number of people. I'd like to focus on neurosciences as one of the areas that is emerging very quickly. If I were going into psychology today and I went to the University of Minnesota, the hotbed of logical positivism, and empiricism, I would seriously look at neuroscience now. The brain in itself is an amazing universe. That was posited 100 years ago. I'm not going to bore you with figures, but between 85 and 100 billion neurons in your head. And these are connected by axons and cables to maybe 7,000 connections each. I mean, it just gets magnanimous how many connections there are. One estimate is maybe 6 trillion different types of connections within a typical brain. This complexity has led to what is called now consciousness, which at this point of research is related to the parietal and frontal lobes as a key part of it. Now, the whole brain functions with this. Philosophers have had a lot of interest in this, going back to Descartes and to Hegel. Scientists are appreciating that. Theologians are appreciating it. Maybe you're aware that the term psyche in psychology in the Greek actually means soul. In Europe, I'd be considered a doctor of the soul. That's not typically said here. The old model of Freud, 100 years, that we have about 10% of our, that we're conscious of, and about 90% unconscious. Jung, in conflict with that, he posited three components of personality, and they're in conflict. He understood Hegel. One of them is the persona. That's our front, almost what we project in a marketing way. Opposite that, in conflict, is what he called the shadow. And this is a very powerful component. If you're not in touch with the possibility of how your shadow influences in the unconscious, you might be operating with a lack of awareness of how you let that be infecting relationships. At the Jung Institute in Zurich, Adolf Guggenbaum Craig wrote the book Power in the Helping Professions. I read it 30 years ago. It changed many of my approaches in therapy, in preaching, in work with parishioners and students. And out of this conflict, Jung would propose that the self, the mature self, develops. I'm not going to go into that. I've written some papers about conscious, intentional evolution, but I'll not go into that. Our consciousness, to a degree, is shared by perhaps a few animals. Not the same, but other elements of it. An infant is really not conscious as we would understand it. They're part of the parent in infancy, but then they develop a sense of self-consciousness. And this, you see this grow. It's really something when you see what Piaget calls formal operations. He called himself an epistemologist in philosophy. I've been at the University of Geneva where he did this. And here's, if any of you have adolescent children, typically they develop in their unconscious a type of imaginary audience. They can think about other than just concrete. They can think about thought. They'll go into the cafeteria and think, oh my gosh, everybody's going to notice that I don't have the right jeans on. They're very self-conscious. They can also develop what probably most of us have done, a personal fable. It's the ideal that we project, have to revise, but that is a component. Erik Erikson, if any of you are familiar with his developmental psychology, and then my friend George Valiant at Harvard has amended this, has a couple of things that might be just very relevant. They have the idea, as we get mature in our middle and later age, of ego integrity. Not ego identity, but ego integrity. And George submits this subtopic, that we leave a meaningful legacy to posterity. He doesn't mean a financial legacy, but something that we find as a meaningful purpose that will contribute to the future. Let me just share this briefly. How is consciousness lost? A month ago, I passed out. I was unconscious. I hit my head. My neck is still a little stiff. Okay. A number of you may have done this. It's an experience that occurs. Now, at the end of life, brain dead in contemporary medical science is considered an indication of death, but it's being questioned now. You want to be aware of that. My late wife, 25 years ago, went into a coma after a very complex, long disease. And after 2 weeks in her coma with a brain dead report, we decided whether or not to terminate and only have palliative care. I was amazed how long her frail body could sustain itself with just comfort. Now, consciousness remains a mystery. To say we are fully conscious is probably an overstatement. We just use a piece of it. And be aware, my friend, it's the collective conscious is our society. I shared with this group one time my concepts about why we make enemies and have difficulty letting them go. My friend, the functions that enemies serve is basically very unconscious for a nation. I was a nuclear officer in the Air Force 60 years ago. Terrible weapons. You know what the mad theory is, mutual assured destruction. If you go to the Soviet Union, I did in the 80s, now Russia, their image of us and our image of them is portrayed out of our unconscious. So, there's more to talk about, but I'm just going to arrest at that point, and it may come up in questions. Now let's hear from John. He has some very relevant material to share.
Jerry talked about neuroscience and consciousness. I'd like to expand on that a little bit, moving into artificial intelligence and consciousness, perhaps. Now, our life forms are carbon-based. Organic life, by definition, is carbon-based. Carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, butane, are the most, can you hear me? Okay, what?
Talk up, I don't hear.
Oh, okay. So our life forms are carbon-based. Now on the periodic table, directly underneath carbon, is the element of silicon, which means it has electron arrangements very similar to carbon. So there's been speculation and questions about, could there be silicon-based life? So far, I don't think it's been discovered. Silicon, it turns out, the bonds and compounds of silicon are very hard and brittle, like glass and sand and things like that. Carbon, on the other hand, makes flexible bonds, and so our skin and bodies can have flexibility. So this question led me to think about something here associated with my professional activities. I know we don't have a real silicon-based life, but maybe some of us have had a metaphorical silicon-based life. Does anybody here have ever worked at Texas Instruments or a semiconductor company? Okay, good. There's a hand. Well, those of us who have worked in that field, basically our whole professional life and incomes and standards of living and so forth, assets, come from silicon. Silicon integrated circuits or silicon devices. It's a whole industry. So that led me to be thinking a little bit. So I did a bit of back of the napkin original research. And I'm going to try to turn the page here without losing it. Whoops. Jerry talked about numbers of neurons and connections in the brain. So I did some. I did some back of the envelope calculations. I do not intend to submit this for peer review, but it makes a point. The number of people on Earth is approximately 10 to the 10th power. It's a little over 100 billion. If you take the number of neurons that Jerry mentioned, the number of neurons in the brain on Earth is about 10 to about 21st power. That's almost a billion trillion. So, having interest in semiconductors and transistors, which are the elements, the switching elements in circuitry made from silicon. There is some industry data available, and it turns out that the number of transistors on Earth is also about 10 to the 21. I'm not sure what that means, but there are projections, particularly by an author named Ray Kurzweil. Is anyone familiar with him?
Mm-hmm.
Good. His thesis, and I can be corrected here, is that at some point in the future, machine intelligence will equal or exceed organic intelligence. And we'll have beings that are hybrids of machine intelligence and brains. Is that reasonable?
Yes.
Well, here's something that might lead to that. The numbers right now are about the same magnitude. But the growth rate is significantly different. The growth rate of neurons is 4 to 5% per year as the world population increases. The number of transistors growth rate is closer to 100%. That's something called Moore's Law, which has been improved, growth rate of transistors. Now, maybe today these are not equal, but someday there's going to be a lot more transistors than there are neurons. What can be done with that? Speculation. When you talk about magnitudes like this in science, that might be an indication of something. So I just toss that out for consideration. Kurzweil projects that what he calls the singularity, when this point is reached, be perhaps 40 years, and other people talk about 100 years or so. How are we doing on time?
Let's see, we're about 10 after 8, so we got about 15 or 20 minutes to go into Q&A.
Okay. I want to spend just a minute touching on some quantum mechanics ideas. My favorite course in college, back in the Middle Ages, middle 20th century, was optics. Optics in those days consisted of geometric optics, which had to do with lenses, microscopes, telescopes, and the way light rays behave. And the other area was physical optics, which is what I really enjoy. Physical optics is tied in with atomic behavior and how light is produced and the different wavelengths, the great fundamentals of light. Light was the first thing to be studied in the development of quantum mechanics. The quantum comes from discrete packages of light energy coming from a light source. And these things were studied in the early 20th century by Max Planck and Albert Einstein in Germany. And Einstein won an early Nobel Prize for discovering of the photoelectric effect, which is the effect of exchanging energy from light to electricity and vice versa. And as time went on in quantum mechanics, other features became obvious and more mysterious and unexplainable. Photons, the energy, and electrons, the electric charge in an atom, behaved as if they were both particles and waves. The particles were considered to be the reality, the real thing, and the waves were considered to be probabilistic possibilities. So I remember hearing an early lecture that the electron that we think is here in my hand might be here or it might be downtown Dallas. The probability is such that it could be anywhere. Now this led to a general discussion about the wave function, that is the electron or photon behaving as a wave had a probabilistic equation. And when it became observed, this wave function collapsed and you could see it behave as a particle. Now, the philosophical questions that come out of that, maybe this is something you've heard also, is that everything is a wave. And it's not visible or not seen, not registered until the wave function collapses. So the wave function collapsing is just another way of saying we can see something. We can observe it. We're conscious of it. And I've read speculation that the reality, the real reality in our universe is our consciousness. Is that a familiar thought, anybody? Okay. I find it hard to accept that myself. But that's some of the prevailing thought that's going around. For example, I think it'd be hard to explain the sun as an imaginary thing until we observed it. But that's my thinking. The other characteristics mentioned about quantum mechanics are there's two characteristics that have been determined. One is called entanglement, and the other is called superposition. Entanglement refers to a situation where you have two electrons or two photons or two entities and they are somehow linked together so that if one of them changes, the other one also changes state instantly, even faster than the speed of light. Superposition refers to a case where an entity, an electron or a photon, can exist in multiple states simultaneously. States of spin or charge or position or polarity, whatever state you want to look for. These two characteristics, entanglement and superposition, are possibly leading to capability called quantum computing, where instead of one state on or off, like our digital computers have today, a state can be called a qubit instead of a bit. And the qubit can have multiple states simultaneously. And if this works, it can lead to a huge increase in computing capability and speed and capacity. It's not easy to get there because these materials are very sensitive. But back when I started in the semiconductor world, integrated circuits as we know them today were extremely hard to make. But it was successfully done. So someday, I think quantum computing will be with us. I'd like to close up here talking to touch on one of the big mysteries in science. I call it the 4% solution. Anybody have an idea what I'm talking about? Nodding your head. If you look at the universe, all the stuff that's in the universe, that is matter and energy, which are equivalent, according to Einstein's equations. Matter comes from energy and vice versa. We only understand about 4% of that. There's another 96% that we do not understand. 70% of that is dark matter, which means that there's gravity in the universe that we can't explain, other than assuming there's some kind of matter creating the gravity. And 70% of the stuff is dark energy, which we can't explain because it's given credit for continuing the expansion of the universe, accelerating its expansion. So in spite of all the knowledge we've generated in the last X number of years in cosmology, physics, and those areas, we've only achieved 4%. I believe that the same kind of gap, call it a gap or insufficient understanding, exists in almost all other fields of science, neuroscience, you name it, genetics. The more they learn in genetics, the more they realize what they don't know, the more things they find out, more complex it is. Which leads me to talk about this program. There's a sheet on some of your tables about a program that's upcoming at our church in February 10th, that we'd advise you to come to. It's a dialogue on genetic technology and religious faith. The speakers will, the scientist will be Dr. Fred Grinnell, who was here at this group recently, and he's excellent. I think you probably would agree. And Dr. Leroy Howe, who's an emeritus professor from Perkins School of Theology, and they have been communicating together about this major field of genetics and DNA, and what's going on, and what are some of the ethical, moral, and religious questions that arise from it. I'll write my email address here. You can read that. It's J. Wiley J. at Verizon.net. So if you would be interested to attend this, I'd like to get more information. I can help you get that information. We certainly would be happy to have anybody here attend and participate. I think we're finished.
Your point. questions, we may not be able to answer many of them. Maybe 4% at the best. So, if we can, maybe somebody here can, or we'll just posit the big questions, because we discover that questions are often more important than answers. The old answers aren't applied to these new discoveries. So let's hear your concerns and your questions. John, don't let me take this alone.
Oh, I'll take permission.
Yes.
How would you define faith?
How would I define faith?
Faith.
Faith or fate?
Faith.
T-H-T-H.
Faith. Faith.
That's what I thought. Well, there's some theological ways to look at it, and it would deal with having a trust in what is unseen. Now, you can have faith in concrete items. I have faith in my car. That's very superficial. But faith in something that is not tangible is where you have to go by trust. It's unseen. It's a mystery. You may have a comment to make. Yes.
Okay. You mentioned the different ways that religion and science can dialogue. Is there anything that science can learn from religion, do you think? And what would be some good examples?
What would be good examples of what?
What science can learn from religion, because you talked about, you know, science-religion dialogue.
Yeah.
And that requires, you know, both sides learn from the other. So
let me work on that one.
Sure.
That's a good question. I think I can quote Einstein correctly here, who said that science without religion is lame. Religion without science is blind. I think that most scientists, with this one, would say that religion is what gives us our values. Science gives us our basic knowledge. So values and morals and ethics, I think, should come from the religious side.
Just to add, there's some very interesting dialogue going on. If you want to get involved, we can put you in touch with some of the more excited. We're finding scientists interested in what you would call faith or religion, and it's amazing how many people in theology are interested, say, in neuroscience at this point.
I think you referenced that there were people questioning the idea that consciousness necessarily ends at right now. When you refer to it and talk a little bit about a coma, but I didn't quite, can you elaborate on that?
I didn't hear it. You dropped off.
Okay, I wasn't using the microphone right. Let me try it again. You referred to people questioning that brain death, or the medical definition of death of the brain, was actually the end of consciousness. Did I understand that right? I was wondering if you could say anything else.
No, I didn't mean that. It might have been inferred. In today's definition, it's considered in most medical science areas as the end of life. In a biological way. Now, some of the persons that, and I'm not real familiar with this, but I'm aware that it's being asked, that there's more to it than the brain function. The body can keep alive. And we're getting some very interesting reports, like a neuroscientist that, maybe you read the book, Evidence of Heaven. Well, that's his, in my estimation, personal perspective, subjective, or might be verified, but we would need more evidence of that. Now, he claims, if you have read it, that 6 days he was in an unconscious state. He came back, but he had memory of what occurred during that time. It's worth reading. Very similar.
Yes, I had a question about consciousness also, but it was more related to the difference between computers eventually being equivalent to or surpassing humans. The difference between computers and humans, as I understand it, is, well, I guess the question is self-awareness a necessary element in consciousness?
Self-awareness.
You want to address one part of it, I'll do the other part.
Well, I will strongly say I don't know, but this book I mentioned by Ray Kurzweil, which is Singularity is Near. His idea is that the hardware, the growth of hardware capability, computer capability, and future growth based on new technologies, and modeling of the way the brain functions, can lead to some form of awareness. That's well, my interpretation of what
we're aware of ourselves through our senses, and I guess you could always build in the senses into computers so that they could see themselves and they could see their surroundings and they could move around. Then I think it'd be very hard to say that the computer was not conscious. I don't see computers doing that at the moment, but it seems like a possibility. But the other thing is that human brain is a wet computer. The biochemicals in the human brain have an enormous effect on motivation and emotions. And I haven't heard of a silicon computer which you could call a wet computer yet.
Well, it probably will not be a silicon computer. It may be a combination of a wet computer, an organic brain, and some form of external hardware, and so that you have a merging of intelligence. That's Kurzweil's thinking.
Just a brief item. Human beings, at this stage of development, we have very limited consciousness. And it's very subjective, our own. Mine would be different from yours. It's very hard to find common ground. Now, science tries to find definitions of what is meant by that. But if you do not have an operational definition, it remains what in philosophy is known as phenomenology. And the phenomena you experience is different from the phenomena I. There's overlap. And so we can share enough to function. There's a lot we don't have.
Have you all read or heard of a book by Dale Black, Journey to Heaven and Back?
From Heaven and Back?
Yeah, that's similar. I'm not sure about the title. It's Journey to Heaven or the Trip to Heaven. And it's by Dale Black. He's a autopilot. He was a pilot. That was his.
I've heard of it, but I haven't read it.
Oh, okay.
Hold that close.
Yeah, it has a particular slant on that sort of thing.
Okay. Somebody over here. We'll catch our breath.
Okay, I'm going to make a fool of myself. Okay, just bear with me here. But I've almost had the feeling that people with Alzheimer's, they are totally aware of everything that's going on, and when I read about all the millions and billions of neutrons and all that that are in the brain with consciousness and all that, could somebody please kind of help me out here on what happens to a brain with Alzheimer's? I just can't give up the thought that they really do know what's going on, it's just they don't express it like we're used to seeing them do.
Let me try. At our Metroplex breakfast, we invited Denise Park, who is the co-director of Brain and Vital Longevity. And she was very helpful. People were interested. You might consider inviting her, because she'll do public events. I didn't get to raise a question that I wanted to, because people at the medical school and University of North Texas in gerontology shared this 2-3 years ago. It's very difficult to define dementia, and it's even more difficult to diagnose Alzheimer's. Now, I'll give a little warning, and then I'll give her reply to me this week. Be very careful, my friends, on a self-diagnosis or using the label to refer to someone. Because they will incorporate their own subjective understanding of it, and here's even very serious. Once healthcare people and friends hear it, they start to get less attention, less care, because they have a negative view. I cannot say if they have a sense of consciousness. They do enough, and I'll give you an illustration. This is one that is sometimes done with animals. We don't have a mirror here, but a few animals, when you place them in front of a mirror, notice that it's about them. It's not another animal. It's about them. Now, how far they can go on this, now, concretely, at our nursing facility, we have Presbyterian North and Grace South. We have an excellent Goodwin Dixon. And here's what he has applied to help understand. Many Alzheimer's patients, if they can't see something, it's not there. It's like a child, 6 to 9 months. If it's not, can't see it, it's gone. He convinced the state health board that they'd be able to show the bathroom visibly to a person so they see it, it's there. Then to help them identify where their room is. They don't put their name. Oh yeah, they put their name. They put a photograph of 40, 50 years ago when they were a younger person. They know that person. They don't know necessarily the current photo of themselves. So we're at a stage. My daughter has started 3 units. For Alzheimer's in nursing home. It's a very challenging field, and be cautious using the diagnosis.
Well, no, these are people diagnosed with the disease, and it's like visit them and ask them and tell them how wonderful they are and tell them stories.
Yeah.
So they've been diagnosed this way. It's not my interpretation. It's
Here's what Denise told me by email.
Let me ask you.
I'll just finish.
Let me just comment. I attended the same lecture by Denise Park that Terry referred to. I learned something. Previously, I had thought that Alzheimer's was characterized by the presence of amyloid compounds in the brain, and something called tau, T-A-U, in this final movie. However, at the talk that he mentioned, it was brought out that not everyone with amyloid has Alzheimer's. So the presence of amyloid may or may not be that significant. So, you know, we need to be careful about calling things Alzheimer, which may not be.
And she cautioned, no, she was hopeful, let me put it. She said, Jerry, we've come quite a ways. We're just at the verge of having a more definitive diagnosis, and it involves brain imaging. And different types of encephalogram. But that's not the whole picture either, but it's coming.
Thank you.
Good question.
I have experience with an Alzheimer's patient because my girlfriend of 34 years actually, has the disease. And what I have learned about it and studied and what's happening with her is that she's not losing consciousness, she's losing memory. And if I can keep her in the here and now, she can make a logical understanding of a reference that I make. But as soon as she has done that, then she's back in a world where she is not remembered. And eventually, the parts of the brain start shutting down. It's not just the memory. From the memory, other parts of the brain shut down. Yeah. They're still function, and that's what they die from.
Sure.
On the other, on another subject, though, are you familiar with Edmund Husserl's definition of consciousness? In which he
Go
says,
ahead.
He's the founder of phenomenology. And his definition was consciousness is nothing in itself, but always and of necessity, consciousness of something. Mm-hmm. So consciousness is actually a function of the brain. It is not a thing, but a function of the brain. And that's all it is.
That's consistent. And your comments about Alzheimer's, I think, are very helpful. Thank you.
Well, what about the philosophy? My definition of consciousness, of course, and the root of the founder of phenomenology, as nothing in itself, but only as a function. It's always consciousness of something. So there's got to be a something, and a brain to consciously know that at the same time.
But Engel also had definition.
The subject and the object in the world, and it takes all three to be conscious of something.
Okay. Yes.
Can you hear me? Yeah. When we talk about the possibility of, you talk about quantum computing and the possibility of more than just a binary, the on-off states where we have multiple, and thus leading to the possibility of life. We can model the brain, but I guess, for lack of a better term, the human spirit, we're more than just our programming. We have imagination. We aspire to something greater. I guess the question is, do we account for that in just the modeling of the brain, or is there something else that can't be modeled in a computer or the brain?
Well, I would recommend this book I mentioned, The Singularity is Near, to read what Kurzweil and some of other information theory specialists are saying about that, your kind of question. I don't know the answer. But they are offering possibilities that something equivalent to a spirit can in fact be modeled. Whether they're right or not, I don't know. But it'd be interesting, I think, for you to see what they're saying about it.
As you can appreciate, consciousness is not clearly defined. It's an emerging type of concept. And if you study the history of how it's used, today we're more aware. In 100 years, I submit, people will be further aware, and that's human consciousness. Now, you can postulate that there is consciousness in different parts of the universe, and we could even talk, a theologian might talk about the consciousness of the divine, God's consciousness.
But there's no evidence for any of that.
Okay, who wants the last question?
They can infer it.
Don't argue
much
because there's no evidence. Yes, I got the
Is there any interest in a book, 50 Shades of Consciousness?
can you give us a summary?
Oh, yeah.
50 Shades of Consciousness. Maybe this group could work on.
That's a good that's a great
since that was short and possible.
There's one over here, right there.
Here?
There.
Oh, okay, we'll give you a second one since nobody else seems to.
Sure, that's okay, you talked a bit about, you know, how an artificial or intelligence or a cybernetic being or something like that could potentially be conscious in a person. How would that be, do you understand like how that could be reconciled with, you know, the notion that man is valuable because he's in the image of God? I'm just going back to the whole theological tie-in, I guess. You know, how do we reconcile man is valuable because he's in the image of God with the idea that, you know, something we create could also be valuable in it being a conscious being? Like, you know, are these irreconcilable? How would that end up working out, do you think?
I'll take a cut at that. As I mentioned, Fred Grinnell is going to come and talk at our church, and he was here at your group a few weeks ago. I met with him last week one day, and he said somebody once asked him, do you believe in God? And he said, I thought about it. Finally said, he said, if you tell me your idea of God, I will tell you if I believe in it. So, I don't know the answer to your question, but for consideration, maybe God, we're in his image, if we can in fact do these kinds of things that we're speculating about, if we have the knowledge and power to do that.
I have heard a theologian say this, that until we are ready to understand something, it is not disclosed to us. People thousands of years ago would not have understood what we are talking about now. And he made the point, it's an unfolding type of revelation. When we are ready, then there'll be more disclosure. It's an interesting concept. You were talking about faith and science, a rabbi around you.
Anybody that doesn't have the rest of the spring schedule that would like one, we got a few up here, so just come up and we'll...
I got some too.
Okay, and Rob has some as well. And let's give a round of appreciation to John and Gabriel.